All right. Hello, everybody. Thank you for the great questions on X. My apologies for taking a while to get to them. So here's a question. Is prison really a punishment for someone if they don't understand their own freedom? It seems the stability of confinement and three hearts and a cot is a sense of relief for some who are unable to bear the responsibility of freedom in the first place, and society pays rent. Well, of course, this comes back to a sort of foundational question about crime and punishment. Do we punish horse thieves because stealing horses is wrong, or do we punish horse thieves so that horses are not stolen? I mean, I suppose both of those things come into play, but is it, well, someone has done something wrong and therefore they need to be punished? Is that what prison is for? Or is prison the last-ditch attempt to preserve the peace and stability of society by taking predatory people out of society? So, in the religious conception of the world, people have souls within them which cannot be fundamentally corrupted. There's always an access to a good person in there, right? So, the analogy would be something like, well, it's true that someone has been a lifelong 40-year pack-a-day smoker, and if the doctor can use the right magic words or phrases, then the emergency backup pink perfect lungs will then replace the corrupt ones, which would really distort the entire discipline of medicine, right? So if you corrupt your lungs through smoking, then, I mean, I suppose you can try and mitigate the damage or deal with the resulting diseases, but there's no emergency break the glass and get the perfect pink lungs to replace your existing corrupt lungs. But, of course, in the religious conception, particularly the Christian conception, there's a perfect soul made by God that, you know, if you repent and seek forgiveness and so on, then your bad brain can be replaced with a good moral brain. And this is kind of tormenting for people. It's really tormenting for people, or it torments people, I suppose is a better way of putting it. It torments people because, for instance, to personalize it a little bit, if I believed that there was a really great mother inside the brain of my not-so-great mother, well, then I would be tormented and I would be trying to fix it and I would spend my entire life circling around trying to figure out how to summon or access or reveal or unlock this great mother. You know, you've heard these stories of people who have locked their bitcoins in some password-protected place, they forgot the password, and so they are tormented, and they are, you know, they can spend years or decades trying to unlock the Bitcoin on this device. And there's a guy, I think he's got 10 password guesses, he's tried 8 of them, and he's terrified of the last two, he's got to really think about it, and hope it'll come to him in a dream or something like that. So if there's a great treasure that you have to unlock, then you're going to try all in your power to unlock this treasure. There's a guy who tossed out, or maybe his wife tossed out, a computer with Bitcoin on it. He knows it's in the landfill, and he's been spending years trying to get the city to let him go to the landfill and get his computer back because it's got, of course, a huge amount of money on it, or Bitcoin, so which is better money. So think of it as you come across a little USB drive, and it's password protected, and you clearly remember that it was just a blank USB drive that you were practicing encryption on or something like that, right? You set up some encryption scheme, and you know it's blank. Then, you know, if you can't remember the password, well, you just reformat it or so, because there's nothing of value on it, right? Whereas, of course, if you come across that same USB drive and that's the and it has, you know, 100 Bitcoin or some crazy number, right? Some whatever it is, 100 Bitcoin written on it, then there's a treasure in there that you're going to move heaven and earth to try and unlock. And so, is the mind like the lungs? Or is there a perfect person always buried inside, even a bad person, that you can access with the right combination of words, the right intervention, the right prayer, the right connection? Is there always the possibility, in the sense of someone or something snapping their fingers and summoning the great lungs. Now, the problem, of course, is that if you believe that there are, like, let's say you're a lung doctor, as I was mentioning, and if you believe that there's a way that you can replace the diseased, corrupt lungs from smoking with perfect pink lungs, as if you've never smoked, then that's going to really inhibit everything that you do when it comes to dealing with people with diseased lungs. In other words, why would you get into all of the medical stuff and the treatments and, you know, maybe removing a lung if it's really, I think that happened to Ayn Rand later on because she was a heavy smoker. And you're going to be, everything you're going to do regarding lung disease is going to be distorted by this belief, or is going to be affected by this belief that you can just find a way to replace the diseased lungs with perfect healthy lungs. And you're not going to look for other things, and you're going to spend your career as a whole focusing on trying to unlock these perfect lungs, if you believe that. And so it's the same thing with the conscience, with the mind, with empathy. So God creates a soul which has empathy and love and virtue and grace, and that is indestructible within the body. It's always there in the body, lurking just around the corner, just under the spleen, just hidden in some Byzantine folds of the brain. There is this perfect, wonderful, great, empathetic, moral person who's in there. You've just got to find him. And then if you find him, find that perfect soul, connect with it, then the badness vanishes and is replaced by goodness, and there's reform and all of this kind of stuff. So, sorry, I don't mean to labor the point too much, but that's kind of my gig. So you have this belief. Now, if, on the other hand, you don't believe in the soul, then the person is the brain. And the brain is really not distinguishable in many ways from the lungs. In other words, if you don't have a conscience, if you don't have empathy, if you're predatory, if you're win-lose mentality, if you're narcissistic, if you're psychopathic, if you're sociopathic, if you're greedy, selfish, mean, nasty, violent, impulsive, and so on, then let's say you commit a bunch of crimes in your teens and you get a bunch of warnings and then you just double down and commit a bunch more crimes in your early 20s, then at some point, you're just going to get thrown in jail and you're going to stay there for quite a while. Is this to punish the person? Punishment being hopefully to reform the person, right? So punishing someone who's incapable of reform is just a kind of cruelty, right? Like, I mean, if a coach yells at a guy with no legs to run faster, well, he can't run faster. He's not capable of it. And if the coach then punishes him for not running faster, we would understand that this would just be a kind of sadism, just a kind of bizarre cruelty, right? So punishing someone who has no conscience will not create a conscience within them, because there's no empathetic, conscience-based soul within the person that can be accessed. So if somebody is antisocial, a criminal, violent, predatory, and evil, then we remove them from society, but not with the purpose of punishing them to make them a better person, because they can't be a better person after a certain amount of evil and criminality. They can't be a better person, because there's no better person in there, and the lungs, after a decade or two of smoking, can't just instantaneously become pink healthy lungs. I mean, so if the person changes course or whatever, like, so let's say you smoke for 10 or 20 years and you quit, or you exercise and so on, then you can, your lungs will heal over time, and your baseline for dangerous diseases goes down. And so on, right? I mean, you look at George Harrison, the guitarist for the Beatles, or one of them, smoked like a chimney, died of lung cancer. Paul McCartney quit smoking, I suppose, and is now in his 80s and all of that. So that's a possibility. So, you know, if you are on a path towards bad things, corrupt things, you're a shoplifter in your early mid-teens or whatever, and then you're like, oh, this is bad, and you change. Right? No, you can recover, but if somebody is really committed and has done a lot of violence, predation, and evil, and remember, by the time somebody is caught, tried, convicted, sent to prison, they've usually been a criminal for a long time, and they've usually done a lot of wrong. This is just the first thing they've been caught for. So recidivism rates are very high. In other words, if somebody's a criminal, goes to prison, gets out, they usually will commit another crime. So are you punishing them with the goal of changing them for the better? Now, of course, everybody hears these anecdotes, and of course, I accept that. Everyone hears these anecdotes of the reformed criminal, right? The guy who was a criminal and then became a nicer, a better person and reformed and all this, that, and the other. And that certainly is the case, that that can happen, so it's not impossible. But I don't know that the person suddenly grows a conscience. Growing a conscience after childhood is like asking someone to grow an arm that got bitten off by a shark when you regrow the arm. It's not something that really happens. But people can adapt and suppress based upon costs and benefits to themselves. So somebody just might get tired of the life of crime and say, you know, fine, I'll get a job. You know, I don't really like getting a job. It's kind of goofy, but it's, you know, I'm tired of the life of crime. It's still hedonism. It's just that crime has become less pleasant compared to getting a job. Same thing happens with addiction. Right? You hit rock bottom and you then don't quit your addiction because you have empathy for others or your future self, right? You quit your addiction because it's just becoming too costly and so on, right? So yeah, people can change, but they can't just grow a conscience. The conscience is like a complicated thing that develops with 13 different parts, 12 or 13 different parts of the brain working together over babyhood and toddlerhood and early childhood, and you can't just go back in time and grow it later. It's like if you don't get enough food to eat as a kid and you grow up 3 inches shorter, you can't just fix that later, right? I mean, you just eat more food, you'll get wider, not taller. So the purpose of prison is to keep the predators away from the general population, in the same way that if there is an aggressive alligator in Florida, say, then the alligator will be relocated to some more remote area where it's not going to come in contact with people. As far as a free market goes, I would imagine that a free market would put prisoners to work and have money go both to the costs of their incarceration and also to recompense their victims. So, all right, do you think the idea that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely might be a falsehood that actually discourages good people from seeking power because they're afraid to risk being corrupted, leaving positions of power to be filled primarily by people who are amoral or corrupt? It certainly is possible, and you know, I'm not going to say it's impossible. We have, of course, seen people struggle to create virtue in corrupt systems, and you can certainly have some good things done for a while. You can certainly have some good things done for a while. So, for instance, in the excesses of crony capitalism and socialism that characterized the England that I grew up in the 1970s, where there were shortages of everything. I couldn't get any meat. We were cold in the winter because coal was short and so on. So Margaret Thatcher comes along and privatizes a bunch of stuff and things get better. And then, you know, things get worse afterwards, right? And England is doing extraordinarily badly at the moment, arguably worse than at any other time in its history. So you can get, like, there's a downward spiral in a sense, and you can get people to bump it up a little bit, but then just other bad people will come in and continue that downward spiral. So power corrupts. And so, yeah, some people come in and will try to lower or diminish the amount of power that the government has. And they might even do some decent work in either preventing or slowing down the expansion of government power or even reducing it in certain circumstances. But the logic of the system is that government power will always and continue to spread because you would have to have a whole bunch of people who had, you know, almost perfect moral fiber go in to government and take on these battles. And government can't really be reduced while government controls the education of children, right? This is a foundational thing, right? So if children are given to the government to be educated, as almost all of them are, then they just bond with the government, right? We bond with our educators. And of course, children can't look at their parents and say, wait, you put me under the control of a corrupt organization like the government? That would be crazy, right? So it's sort of like saying we should have moral slave owners. Now, of course, if you are a slave, you don't want to be the slave of a sadist, right? This sort of story of Dostoevsky's father was such a brutal serf owner that, and such a drunkard, that the serfs rebelled and tied him down and forced him to drink liquor until he died. I mean, that's how angry they were and how horrified they were at his brutality. So if you are a slave or a serf, then obviously you would prefer a more gentle and kind master to a more cruel and sadistic master. For sure. Of course. But the problem is slavery and serfdom. The problem is that you have to try and depend on the personality or character of the person who's involved in wielding that power, and that's bad, because the general tendency is to more cruelty. And the other thing, too, is that it's not just that power corrupts, it's that it is impossible to wield power in a moral and productive way. So a simple example from Austrian economics is you cannot have an efficient allocation of resources without the price system. The price system signals empirical supply and demand for free, right? If the price of something is going up, then the supply is going down while the demand remains constant, or the demand is going up faster than the supply. So you just, if the price of copper goes up, then people who have a bunch of copper wiring in their basement may be motivated to sell it, which no central planner is going to understand. Like, you can't have efficient allocation of resources. I just remember I debated this with Peter Joseph years ago. So you cannot have an efficient allocation of resources without the price system, and you can't have the price system without the free market. So even if you wanted to be efficient as some sort of socialist central planner, it's impossible to do so. So my goal is not to say to people, be nicer in your pursuit of power. And of course, you know, I think Trump did some good stuff, but, you know, the pandemic response and all of that was just absolutely catastrophic. So, all right. Next question. You remove the power. Don't ask people to do it better, especially when sometimes they can't. Another question. What would lead you to abandon UPB as a, quote, proof of secular ethics? That's a dipshite troll question, because it frames my advocacy or rejection of arguments in a personal manner. In other words, if you don't know what would cause me to reject a proof, then you don't understand me, my work, or philosophy as a whole at all. At all. It's like asking somebody, it's like asking a scientist, what would cause you to abandon the scientific method? I mean, a philosopher is someone who organizes his or her thoughts according to reason and evidence. So if you say, I can't imagine what would cause staff to abandon UPB, which is universally preferable behavior, my rational proof of secular ethics, or the rational proof of secular ethics, what would lead you to abandon it? Well, if it was proven to be self-contradictory, right? And if somehow, let's say communism was far more economically productive and produced far more freedom than the free market, right? So that would be the evidence, because communism is a violation of UPB by using the initiation of force and denying property rights. Communism is a violation of UPB. The free market is an affirmation of UPB. So one piece of evidence that would be interesting to explore is if central planning was much more economically productive and produced greater human freedoms and well-being than the free market. That would be evidence against, that would be interesting to explore. But yeah, if UPB was self-contradictory, then I would abandon it. And if it was opposed by evidence, right, so reason and evidence, as I said. So if somebody is saying, well, what could possibly lead you, a philosopher who's devoted to reason and evidence, to reject a theory? That means you don't understand that I organize my thoughts by reason and evidence. You don't even understand the basis of what it is that I'm doing. And it's snarky and bitchy, because you're saying, well, I mean, I can't possibly, like, you have such an emotional attachment, Steph, to UPB, like, what could possibly cause you to abandon it? It's like, just disprove it. Just disprove it. But you can't. You can't disprove it. Yeah, it has withstood close to 20 years of relentless assaults. Everybody I've talked to it accepts the basic premises. And so even a professor of logic who's called in from time to time, who's very hostile to UPB, has accepted it. So yeah, it's just true. All right. Why do you think some listeners are able to feel their anger, says the question, when talking about their families, while others struggle to access it during calls? So if you're going to ask me why people with the same circumstances have different reactions, then you are, in a sense, trying to draw me, I'm not saying consciously, and I'm not even saying it's a bad thing to ask, of course, right? But logically, you're trying to draw me into determinism. When people feel angry, so I'll give you an example from my own life. So when I was a kid, I had to suppress my emotions because I was raised by a very violent and selfish woman. So I had to suppress my emotions because my emotions interfered with her preferences, and then she would get violent or aggressive or something like that. And so after high school, I went to work in Northern Ontario, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan as a gold panner and prospector. And not always in the bush, but at least half and half of the time I was in the bush. And so I remember reading The Psychology of Self-Esteem, which was the first book that I really read. The first book that I read that really got me into the process of self-knowledge. And Nathaniel Brandon was like, oh, you should accept your emotions, right? So I remember I was in Thunder Bay and I was chatting with this attractive young woman at a disco or a bar. It was a bar where they had live music. It was really great. And I remember asking her about her mother, her childhood, her family, her history, all kinds of stuff. I was doing this even at the age of 18. And we chatted for a while, and then she went somewhere else, and then she came back, and we chatted some more, and I gave her my number. And I used to work out at the, I think it's Lakehead University. I had a membership at the gym when I was in town. I'd work out there. And I remember sitting in a couple of days after I met this woman at the bar, gave her my number, and I remember sitting in the sauna, and I was like, hey, she never called, right? And I felt this sort of stab of disappointment that she'd never called. And then I took a deep breath, blow it away, get rid of the feeling, right? Because that was my habit as a child and as a teenager, and not just at home, but other places as well, school and so on, right? And so, I remember Nathaniel Brandon and his, you should feel your feelings, they're not your enemies, and so on. And so I was like, you know what? Let me not do that. Let me feel the feeling. And so I thought about this woman and the fact that she hadn't called me. And I let myself feel sad or disappointed or whatever it was, right? I just let myself feel that feeling. And I sort of made a vow to myself to stop pushing my feelings away, to accept my feelings and so on, right? And this is a little over 40 years ago. And so why? Well, I mean, you can look at all this causality. My best friend was into Rush. The drummer for Rush was into Ayn Rand. He gave me The Fountainhead. I read it. The Fountainhead led me to Nathaniel Brandon, who led me to accepting my feelings, which is not exactly something that's done in Ayn Rand's novels and so on. So you can look at all, but it comes down to a choice. It comes down to a choice. That objectivism was a philosophy that I quite respected, and Nathaniel Brandon, in terms of self-knowledge, was a thinker, and I actually did get to interview him later, but he's a thinker who I respected, and so on, a psychologist that I respected, but I made that choice. I made that choice to pursue self-knowledge. I made that choice to start accepting my own emotions, which has been great over the course of my life, and so on. So I can't put it to causality. You know, there's lots of people. In fact, my friend who gave me my first Ayn Rand book had, to me, a goofy and foolish relationship with self-knowledge. He said, even as a teenager, he said he knows himself perfectly, which I thought was kind of a goofy guess or whatever it is. And so, as a whole, even though he read The Psychology of Self-Esteem, he did not get from it what I got from it. And in fact, I think I got deeper and better things from the book. So we had exposure to the same material, but we had different conclusions out of it and so on. So why are some people able to feel their anger? Others struggle to access it during calls? The first cause that I would think is simply punishment. So in some families, you're allowed to have screaming matches with your parents. Like as a teenager, the hormones hit and your independence hits and your revulsion at compulsion from above hits. And so you can have screaming matches with your parents. And so you're able to get angry. In other families, if you even start to raise your voice at your parents a little, they'll beat you up. Like your dad might beat you up and so on, right? So then you can't get angry because it's going to threaten your survival. So it would probably be something like that. Do you think, next question, do you think it's possible for a machine to actually know things or just process code? Yes, it seems like the entire stock market is riding on a sentient computer coming to life. What do you think? No, computers can't know things. They can't think. They can't reason. They're not organic. They don't have dreams. They don't sleep. They don't have intuition or instincts. They don't have the second brain gut, which has a bunch of neurons in your belly. They don't have any of that stuff. It is just binary. AI is just a word guesser. And it guesses words pretty well, and it can be very thoughtful and so on. So no, sentient computers, they're not coming to life. They don't think. If a child is found torturing animals, do you think the child should be euthanized? Good heavens, no. Good heavens, no. A child who's torturing animals is almost certainly suffering either from some brain dysfunction, some organic brain dysfunction, or severe child abuse. So no, of course not. You would try to help the child and to turn that child away from the disasters that are coming without an intervention, and you would try and figure out what's going on wrong with the parenting. Somebody asks, you've said many times that the virtuous path is lonesome. We're not finding people that make their children the number one priority, and we've cut ties with those who are abusive, neglectful, who have sent their children to daycare. What can we do to find peaceful parents? So lonesome is interesting. You know, the idea of the lonely crowd. Like, nothing's more lonely to me than being with a group of people and not being able to be honest or speak my thoughts or be myself. See, if I'm alone, I can have my own thoughts, I can write, I can read, I can podcast, I can daydream, I can go for a walk and enjoy the scenery and so on, right? So if I'm on my own, I'm not disconnected from myself. If I'm with people where I can be myself and be honest, I'm not disconnected from myself. The thing that is most isolating is to be with people and not be able to be yourself. Then you don't get the authenticity of being alone, nor the connection with the true self that comes from being honest with people. So lonesome? No, it's not lonesome because you have a great connection with your spouse and you have a great connection with your children. So what can we do to find peaceful parents? Well, just take a leadership position, right? There's meetup.com. There's tons of places where you can go and just try and get a meetup going and say, you know, we're interested in peaceful parenting. We take this approach to parenting, even if people don't know the technical terms, and just try and meet up with people. So just don't wait for people to come. Don't wait for virtuous people to come your way. Go out and find them, right? It's like I want to go hunting. I'm going to wait for the deer to show up in my living room, right? Sorry, I know that's not the best analogy, but you know what I mean. Somebody says, recently you've had a few shows like, I'm 30 and I'm male and my life hasn't started. Why does it seem to be happening so often these days? Because men are raised without fathers in general. And men are raised without need, right? I had to go and work up north. My family needed the money, and so I had to go. My brother did it before me, and I did it after him. And so I had needs. I had to go. And so there's no particular need, and there's no father urging them forward, and they don't have a larger life mission. So just become a porn and video game hedonist, right? All right. Are concepts more powerful than individual physical instances when it comes down to influencing people's psyche and behavior? I would say in general, yes, because most people are entire slaves to abstract concepts that don't exist, right? Religion and statism and the automatic value of parents. That people are of value simply because they're your parents or your brother or your sister and so on. These are abstract standards or concepts that do not exist and seem to influence just about everyone the most. All right. Question is, there any behavior that could be universally preferable in which the user is forced to be at a loss or sacrifice, i.e. something like donating blood, which is generally good but couldn't be up because an anemic would not want to donate. Oh, couldn't be UPB because an anemic would not want to donate blood. Yeah, I'm not allowed to donate blood either, so because of my prior medical history. So is there any behavior forced to be at a loss or sacrifice? No. No. Because UPB is that which you can use violence to enforce, right? So you can use violence to prevent somebody from assaulting you or raping you or murdering you and so on. Right, so you can use force for that. You can't use force to make someone sacrifice. You can't use force to make someone give blood. All right. Where does the human's ability to reason come from? If by evolution, how did it actually evolve to become the reason we have today? Reason comes from the stable properties and behavior of matter and energy conceptualized in the mind. How we learned how to conceptualize, this is the origin of consciousness in the bicameral mind, how we learned to create universal abstractions from particular sense data is an unknown. It is an unknown, and nobody has that answer. But it's an interesting question, right? Last question, why do I masturbate so much? Well, the problem is I keep doing shows, and obviously I'm the biggest turn-on in the known universe. So as long as I keep doing shows, you will continue to have that urge and impulse. Of course, I fully understand that. freedomain.com/donate. Thank you so much for your time, care, affection, and attention. It means the world to me. And don't forget, see me in Nashville, Tennessee, September 12th, 2026. Go to wordwardebate.com. Lots of love, my friends. Bye.